CFO Radio is the only radio show that explores the passion of today's CFO and examines the innermost thoughts of the financial world, financial perspectives of tomorrow. Welcome to CFO. I'm Lorraine Chilvers.
And I'm Lee Cantor, and I'd like to thank our sponsors before we get started. Delaney Consulting, LLC, providing financial leadership to fast-growing companies, interim management, and executive placement for the finance function. Visit DelaneyLLC.com and learn why 100% of their clients describe Delaney's services as outstanding and excellent. Also, National Association of Corporate Directors, an association created for directors by directors whose mission is to advance exemplary board leadership. We are sponsored by the Atlanta chapter.
And in this week's CFO Radio News, we have an article originally published by CFO.com. In fact, it is their Business Outlook Survey published in December 2011, looking into the new year. And it's headed, CFOs are more optimistic than last quarter and plan to do some hiring in the year ahead, according to the latest Duke/CFO Global Business Outlook Survey, written by Kate O'Sullivan. And the article goes on to say that CFOs are slightly more optimistic than they were 3 months ago, despite the ongoing European debt crisis and continued uncertain demand at home, according to the latest Duke University CFO Magazine Global Business Outlook Survey. Finance executives rate their optimism about the U.S. economy at 53 out of 100, 53%, which is up from 47% last quarter, but still below the survey's long-term average of 60. Finance chiefs plan to increase hiring in the year, but are still cautious, putting the chance of a new recession at 30%. These mixed signals reflect the very varied results at individual businesses. On one hand, for example, Mark Mustavich, finance chief at heavy-duty truck dealer JX Enterprises, says, "Our little corner of the economy is doing very well, thanks in part to customers' increasing need for parts and service as they keep old vehicles on the road." On the other hand, Milton Bullock, CFO at Alpha Steel, a steel fabrication company that has seen its business cut in half over the past few years, reports that the economy for the year ahead is still brutal, citing a lack of demand for the company's products, mainly used in building schools, strip malls, and multi-story office buildings. Alpha's business has shifted to focus on federal government contracting in recent years, with good results, said Bullock. That is what's keeping us going. Rob Ogilby, CFO at Wish Farms in Florida, says his business is relatively insulated from the economy as demand for the company's strawberries and other produce typically outstrips supply. "As for the broader economy, I think we're basically going to have a repeat of 2011, he says. "It's a perception issue. We see growth in some sectors, but the typical American sees a bad economy, and that's what they're reacting to." Now, in terms of hopes for hiring, on average, CFOs do plan to boost spending in key categories, says CFO.com. And these categories are such as capital spending, which they say will increase by 8% over the next 12 months. Technology spending will grow by 6%, while research and development spending will increase by nearly 3%, and marketing and advertising spending will grow by about 2%. On the critical jobs front, finance executives have a somewhat improved outlook compared with last quarter, now saying that they plan to increase their full-time domestic workforces by 1.5% on average over the next year. Such an increase would yield enough jobs to reduce unemployment rate, currently at 8.6% nationally, by a percentage point by the end of 2012. And we'd like to thank CFO Magazine and CFO.com for that article. Well, today I need to apologize to our guests. I'm sitting here and you perhaps sound a little bit of a difference in my voice. I'm just coming off the flu, so I hope things are going well. And I am joined by a guest that I have actually personally worked with at four different companies, Gloria Beck. She is joining us today to discuss the role of the controller as it relates to the CFO function. And I'll tell you a little bit about her background. Her career includes being a controller, consultant, senior manager, accounting manager, and general ledger manager for public, private, and nonprofit corporations. Gloria was a senior manager and part of the restatement team for WorldCom MCI, which was then acquired by Verizon. She was also part of the restatement team for Novelis Inc., rolled steel manufacturer. She was an interim controller with the consulting practice of Tatum. During her career, she's been the controller on an interim basis for several companies, including that of Hands On Atlanta, Direct Path, Direct TV, and Miles Properties. She's performed various consulting and interim staffing roles with Fortune 1000 companies, including BellSouth, Internap, and private companies such as Merial, a joint venture of Merck. Gloria is an accomplished professional with 25 years finance and accounting experience. Her focus is effective management of internal controls, operational efficiencies, and technology solutions. Gloria has a Bachelor of Science, Business Administration from the Barry University, Miami, Florida, and attended graduate school accounting at Guildford College in Greensboro, North Carolina. Well, my goodness, Gloria, that's an awful lot of stuff, an awful lot of experiences. Welcome to the show, Gloria.
Thank you, Lorraine.
Well, Gloria, it's a pleasure having you on the show. As I say, we've worked together at four different companies, and I think we're soon to go into the fifth company. It's a pleasure to be able to explain to the listeners that we have today your varied roles that you have experienced, not only as that employee, W-2 employee, but as a consultant, whether that's been an employee or as a 1099. And that's a little bit of a scary place for some people. So today's interview will go through a lot of your career experiences and talk about some of the challenges and some of the highlights.
Very good.
So, Gloria, let's start at the beginning. What was your first job?
Actually, my first job was in high school when we sold magazines.
What kind of magazines is that? Was that a publication of the high school?
No, actually, it was a magazine publishing company, and they hired teenagers. And we fielded the telephones, and we actually took the orders and went out and delivered the magazines.
Wow. So let's take from teenage magazines to today, Gloria being a consultant, to very large and small privately held companies. What was the path in between? How did you get from there to here?
Oh, that's a good question. And actually, it has to do, I think, with the beginning work ethic. If one is encouraged to start early and has good experiences, you're likely to want to continue those successes in the business world. In my own particular example, I could probably best explain it as a journey, one that started in the 1980s when I became interested in accounting.
And these are the days, were you on computers in those days, or were you on pieces of paper?
Pieces of paper at that time.
So I remember those old folio ledgers with big binders.
Very much so. Green ledger sheets.
Yep.
Yes. I had earned a business degree, but became very interested in accounting and then returned to graduate school so that I could obtain all of the accounting knowledge needed to launch a new career. My first hiring as an accountant was at a regional CPA firm. I joined their tax practice, and during the time there, I was given the opportunity to prepare tax returns for small and medium business clients.
Interesting that you say that. A lot of our guests have started with a CPA firm, whether it's been a regional one or one of the large, you know, the big eight, the big six, the big four. And a lot of our guests say that that really was a strong foundation for them. And particularly for you, the tax side of that, has that been helpful to you?
That's been very helpful. And you're absolutely right. It depends on that first experience in accounting. The regional CPA firm that I worked with had excellent processes, procedures, resource materials, libraries, and they were very clear about producing an excellent product. However they were to do it, they of course had a tax department, an audit department, and a small business department where they actually helped bring out the financial statements. Now, when I was doing the tax returns, of course, I was responsible for transferring the data from the financial statements, the balance sheet, and the income statement onto the tax returns. We had to review them and make sure that they were correct and that they made sense and they were going into the right area. And in doing this process, I became more interested in the accounting side than the tax side.
Oh, so you were jumping ship while you were in the job.
Exactly. And at that point, decided to become a corporate accountant.
So what was your next step? Did you left the CPA firm and you went into more of an accounting type role?
I did. I came to Atlanta and began working for a large multinational engineering firm. My introduction to corporate accounting in this firm came at a time of great business transition, and these transitions and transformations were because of the great leaps in technology and communication that were occurring during that time.
So were the companies acquiring? Was this during the acquisition stage? Did you help with any of those kind of acquisitions?
Well, there were multiple things going on at this time, and you're absolutely right. One of the first things that we had to adapt to was the move from spreadsheets and these ledgers that you and I talked about earlier into software applications. And the use of accounting software at that point was considered just uncharted territory. New not only to the programmers, but to the accounting end users as well. And we all had to adapt. This, I think, is where the expression came, learning to think outside the box. We were tasked with maintaining GAAP and moving volumes of data through unfamiliar systems and producing accurate results in financial statements.
And, of course, today's accountant does that without even blinking. They perhaps haven't, somebody younger going through the field of study in the profession of finance and accounting, very often I find that particularly those that are maybe less than 30 years old or 35 years old, if you were to talk to them about a folio ledger or to actually bring them out a book, very often they're not familiar with that.
That's a good point. And the training that I received during that part in my accounting career was just wonderful because it really did help you become an excellent analyst. You had to work with other people, other professions, and people within your own profession to determine the real nature of a business. And what we tried to do was stay very basic. We tried to remember, as in accounting, all transactions begin with an agreement. And the agreement dictates how that transaction moves through the accounting cycle.
That's a very unique perspective on it, and I like how you've taken it back to essentially the source point of data. That's what accounting is. It's what transaction are you trying to record? And I know that I've been in some really complex situations, and I tend to go back when I've had some of the most complex accounting situations. In my career, I go back to the cash account and I look at a transaction if it had been cash related, and I book the entries and T account them out. I've got that founding just like you, and it helps me understand all the complexities. And I've been involved with some high level foreign exchange derivatives transactions for companies that are making acquisitions, that share for share deals. Some very, very complicated transactions. And to your point, it's all about the transaction, going back to that source document.
It is. I remember taking years and years ago advanced accounting, and the professor was a bit intimidating. And on my first day there, he asked if anyone in the class knew how to really track and analyze a transaction. And we were all going to come up with complex responses to his question. And basically, his answer to us was, a T account. No matter what happens, no matter how complex your transaction becomes, use the T account. And that was valuable, and I use that all through my career and even today. And you're right, things have become so complicated. Data comes from so many different sources that it needs to be tracked and analyzed from inception through its process. And you have to make very, very sure that it's reaching its intended destination. And that it's accounted for properly all along the way.
Now you're getting into some topics. We've talked about thinking outside the box. I think you're getting into some topics related to the audit trail, very much in terms of that agreement, the process that it takes. Is much of your focus on the controls aspect, the audit trail of making sure that you can come after the fact and see the path that you've trodden?
Absolutely. And there is a process, and you follow the trail, and you follow the process, and along the way, you determine if there are breaks in the process, if you need to do any correction to finally arrive at where the transaction was meant to occur. This process that we are following along an audit trail has to be tracked within a specific frame of time. And frequently, financial statements are misstated, because the time period is not accurately captured or the transaction in that time period is not accurately reported. And that's extremely important along the way.
And of course, your experience has included some very large multinational billion-dollar worldwide restatements. You were part of the restatement team for WorldCom, which I think to this day is still the largest bankruptcy and fraud that ever existed in the world. And you were part of the restatement for Novellis. In fact, if I recall our conversations, you were involved in the cash complex areas of that restatement, and you were involved in the receivables restatement for WorldCom. Talk to us a little bit about that aspect of audit trail. Does the audit trail always exist?
It should always exist, yes, and often doesn't.
Now, what causes that lack of audit trail? Is it something that's done wrong in the company? Is it errors? Is it oversight?
It can be so many different things. In the 90s, as you all will recall, we had this frenzy for mergers and acquisitions, and this combination of people and resources and software and locations caused many problems. We were unable to get all of the information together, so each of those situations had their own audit trails, as it were, and the idea is how to combine them onto one path according to the intended, again, purpose of these transactions or the early on agreement. We had complex agreements, multiple agreements within agreements. One thing that comes to mind was at Bell South when it turned into Singular, we had to account for cell towers. Now that would seem very straightforward initially, but the cell towers had to be constructed and we owned them at the time. They were on leased land, so we had land agreements. We also had shared use agreements of the cell towers with other telecommunication companies, we had short-term and long-term leases, and we had to determine whether they were capital or expensed leases. In other words, were they going to be on the balance sheet or the income statement? So this one transaction of having one cell phone tower for people to use for the cell phones was a very complicated transaction. No one knew really how to put it together.
And, of course, you were there at the infancy stages of cell towers and cellular technology. So you were one of the pioneers, if you will, forging the accounting as part of your consulting arrangement. And you were advising the companies as to how to account for this at Bell South?
Yes, exactly. And as I said, we had to develop new ways of analyzing the data, of breaking it apart, breaking it down, so that we could say at this point in time, the transaction looked like this and should have been recorded according to GAAP at that point in time like this. Mm-hmm. Then the next period of time, we had more things that were added. We needed to break them apart, analyze them, make sure each part had its place in the financial statement and in that transaction. another thing that we experienced at Singular was the technology of the cell phones and the equipment that went with them. We would have situations where processes were not in place in order to handle the transactions. So in other words, you might have widgets, huge box of widgets sent to a customer, and the customer would receive them, but in the meantime changed his mind. Well, from our accounting perspective, we had recorded revenue, but the customer returned the gizmo or the widget, and he returned it by a different freight line, and it went to a different warehouse, and that warehouse got it, didn't really know what to do with it, threw it in the corner. So sales then was upset about their customer. They would send them another gizmo or widget. And in terms of accounting, we thought we had two sales transactions. We never received the credit for that original returned gizmo.
And I've seen this at many, many companies across many, many industries. And I've also seen this in service-related environments. I would imagine that as part of that restatement on the receivables, you saw that at WorldCom as well with the service cutoff, whether something was revenue or whether it really should have been a credit of another form to the customer.
Exactly right. That's a very good point. Service was very difficult to track, and the revenue from service was very difficult to track. We had different territories, different closing statements in those territories, closing dates in which revenue was recognized.
And I guess different billing systems?
Yes, different billing systems. And all of that information, again, had to be coordinated and organized into the major financial statements. And, of course, since they were public companies, they were under SEC scrutiny to follow certain rules.
Mm-hmm. And I guess in a service-related environment, very often your dependency of that cutoff action is based on a telephone call from the customer. So this is something that's pretty hard to track in accounting systems. How do you track a telephone call from a customer? Is it through some kind of a customer-oriented reporting that comes through systematically?
Well, that's a good question, because what is in play here is what should happen versus what did happen and what does happen. There have been many attempts to be able to classify and coordinate that information, not only from the perspective of setting up a returns contingency in your financial statements, but to understand how that moves. What happened initially with some of the bigger corporations was the customer would either call their salesperson, or they would file a complaint or want a return online. Now, the salesperson was not connected to the accounting department. Again, we have that situation where they did not want to lose a customer. They wanted to satisfy them. So they may have a lag in reporting it or setting up a credit document. They're not paperwork oriented. And sending it to accounting. So accounting at this point just doesn't know that there is a return issue and doesn't know where it resides.
So accounting is still reporting revenue.
Yes, exactly.
Life's
right.
Happy.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Then one day someone says, you know, Joe has this box of returns over here, and I think he's left, but we need to account for it. So when you start looking at it, and that's an oversimplification, of course, because there were multiple boxes and multiple returns. You had millions of dollars that had not been reported, and revenue was greatly overstated. This, of course, required us to do a heavy analysis, and we had to go back and reduce revenue, take a hit to revenue. One of the things that happens when this occurs is the period that you want to take the hit to your revenue. And that becomes a huge issue. There are a lot of accounting issues that were particularly analyzed and looked at, not clearly covered by GAAP. And those are the rules that we're supposed to follow when doing accounting.
Interesting. So all of these experiences, and you've mentioned merger frenzies, technology software audit trails, you've seen an awful lot of different aspects of accounting and finance. One thing that I would like to highlight is that in the conversations that you're giving today in your responses, I wonder whether when you're referring to the accounting issues, some of these roles you've been as an employee, some of these roles you've been as a consultant. Can you describe your experiences as a consultant and then as the controller, interim controller? Is it different from the perspective of being that employee versus that consultant?
I would use the example of probably MCI. When I was first introduced to the company, I was coming in as a consultant. This allowed me to kind of move around a bit in the company and see what kind of accounting was going on. It was easier to be at that point a consultant because you were generally given a project or an area to analyze and be able to find resolution to any problems.
So you were solving problems. You were hardcore getting in, doing the accounting, and helping with the restatement.
Right, and that was a part of the company. But the other part, of course, is the day-to-day activities that go on while that restatement is occurring.
So still closing the books, still writing payroll, still paying checks.
Mm-hmm, exactly right, and the timing of all of that. And most of the staff during restatements are not adequate. There's just not enough number of them to be able to get this accomplished. So that's why the accounting consulting industry grew so rapidly. They really needed help. They had needed allies to help them convert the data appropriately. And when we began to see the entire picture, meaning how the work we were doing integrated into their day-to-day activities, we knew that we needed to help them understand the new process that we may have designed the processes probably were broken somewhere, had some problems, and whereas we could find it, suggest resolution, it still had to be integrated into a new process for the day-to-day activities that was involving the controller on a very intimate level, so that we had to actually dovetail our processes together and see how we could best improve the day-to-day activities.
Well, that I think also is something that you have touched upon when you referred to your consulting days at Bell South. You were at Bell South in a period of tremendous acquisition and tremendous growth. Talk to us maybe about some of your projects that were there. Were they always accounting? You've talked a little bit about technology. Did they span the gap?
They spanned the gap, actually. One of my projects there that was most interesting was an inventory warehouse project. I mentioned the obsolete equipment that was returned, and then it was returned to multiple warehouses in multiple locations, and no one really had a tracking process. They were able to receive the inventory, process it, and move it out to the customer. But there were not good processes in place for receiving back the inventory and returning it into the financial statements. In other words, back into inventory.
And if I recall rightly, Bell South had actually outsourced this process to the warehouse management firm that they were using to do the logistics. Want to make sure that on air we don't kind of knock or Bell South. Part of bringing the consultants in was that they actually felt that there was an issue, and you were brought in to investigate, and they actually ended that management outsourcing relationship because of the issues that you found, and they brought it in-house.
They did, that's true. One of the situations that we often run into is we need to learn to compare our internal documentation and reporting to the vendors or customers' reporting.
So what happened when you did that?
We found discrepancies, of course, and then we had to identify the discrepancies, and we had to give supporting documentation for those discrepancies. And oftentimes, documentation was spotty. It was not clear. So you had to determine the value of the documentation. Is this something I want to use? Is this something that could hold up in a court of law? Is this something that really is valid to support what I'm saying?
So as part of that review project, you went in. Was it kind of like an audit investigation?
Very much so.
Forensics type work. Did you were actually on site at the vendor, by the sounds of it, digging through their paperwork.
Absolutely, and also digging through their inventory, actually looking at the physical inventory of boxes.
How did that go? Did the vendor want you there? I think I know the answer.
Not particularly, but we both learned from it. We learned that we both should have been tracking the processes better. Then we wouldn't have any sort of lack of communication about it. We both would have known, I have this number of gizmos that were returned. Did you sell those, or did you provide us with those, or were they returned to you, or did they come back to me?
Back to the source document.
Right, and we didn't have communication channels that were very efficient at that point. Everyone was scrambling to take care of their own corporation because of the large sizes and the software transfers and everything that was going on then. It was complicated enough to keep your own boat afloat, much less to bring someone else in. So we had heavy dependence on their information being correct, and I think vice versa.
And so as part of this acquisition, Bell South basically, unfortunately for them, purchased a situation with an outsourced vendor. They weren't happy with them. They brought you as a consultant in to do the review. It sounds like they ended the relationship. And what happened after they brought it in place? Were the recommendations that you made put into place? Did they increase their communication? How did they accomplish that reporting? Were you part of that process?
I was. And actually, we helped to develop a plan that involves several areas of the company that we hadn't even looked at before. One of those areas was the insurance part of the company. The cell phones and some of the equipment was insured.
So through a warranty program?
Yes. And we found that we had not tracked that process very clearly, but it was definitely related to the inventory problem. People were claiming insurance on lost phones or returned phones, and there was no tracking there to see where were the phones and were they damaged and this type of thing.
So that now involves tracking at the serial number level per cell phone in accounting records.
Yes, very, very complicated. And as I said, technology kept changing, and we were saying, is that a Nokia 1020 or is that a Nokia 1040? Was that the later one? Was that the earlier one? Is it obsolete? Should we write it off? Are people using it? We have to tell marketing. There were so many questions that came about, and one of the hardest things to deal with, I think, is the lag of finding a problem and fixing it, because marketing and the business mission of the company continue, and they continue very aggressively, as they should, in order to earn their profits and gain their market share.
And I think that is a challenge for many, many companies. Interestingly enough, you've touched on several topics that many of our guests on the radio show have spoken to. Several of our CFO guests have said that the number one element that they focus on is getting closer to the customer. And everything that you're referring to is understanding the customer interaction, whether the customer is on the end of the user, or whether the customer perhaps is a distributor or a middleman. But tracking that and understanding the accounting, at the detail level, it's quite complex.
It's very complex, and it all relies heavily upon the ability to report the numbers accurately to management so that they can make their decisions. If we have too much of a lag, we're not reporting correct numbers, and they can't make the decision. For instance, they may need to have a division shut down because it's not being as profitable as they thought, and also it may be having too many problems that can't be corrected, and it will pull down some other areas where they would have to divert funds to that and not get the return that they expected.
Now, as you look back on your career, you've had a lot of challenged environments that you've gone into, and you've had a lot of environments where you've gone in and perhaps day to day and month to month has been a little more stable. As you look back onto some of those more complex, was it fun? Was it tiring? Was it challenging? Would you do it again?
All of those things, yes. It was a lot of fun. It really was. It was so challenging because so many accountants, you'll hear us say, we loved solving the puzzle. And the more pieces they gave us, the more we liked solving it. We wanted to be sure we got it all back in place.
You're kind of a detective.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And that is fun. And you feel good at the end of the day. Yes, you're tired and you've had some challenges and some things you wish didn't happen during the day. But on the other hand, you feel really good about the results you were able to achieve.
Awesome. So let's talk a little bit about some of the more stable environments that you've been into. And I'm hoping that in your experiences, you actually have some more stable environments that you can talk about. But let's talk about this perhaps in the role of you going in as the interim controller versus the, what I would describe, W-2 employee controller. When you look at a controller role versus some of these consulting and engagements that you've had, is the role of controller more stable in itself? Is it more routine?
You know, that's a difficult question. It depends on the company and the expectations of the company. They may determine that an interim controller would be better qualified to get them back where they wanted to go, to help them solve back accounting issues or get an audit up to date, or help them design new procedures for procurement or internal controls, all of those things. Then they may decide to hire a permanent controller to handle the day-to-day. It's very, very difficult to handle day-to-day activities and do past catch-up work and to complete an audit. And this is what we have to do as an interim controller many times.
So very often on an interim basis, you're doing what I might describe as cleanup.
Yes, exactly.
You're running behind the horse with the shovel.
Yeah.
And somebody else has got to be up front leading the horse, right?
Exactly.
A little bit of a gross visualization, but to your point, you've got to have somebody managing day to day, and you've got to have somebody doing cleanup.
Right. And at the same time, as you introduce new processes and procedures, to the company, you have to deal with change management. That's probably a very, very difficult aspect that we all had to face.
And how do companies manage that, in your opinion? Do they do a good job at it?
Some of them bring outside specialists in who specialize in change management, where they try to educate the employees about this is where we were, this is the cause for the change, and this is where we want to go. And we want you to come along with us, and we want to train you and help you get there. But traditionally, people do not like change. And they may agree with it, but you may have loss of personnel because they're not comfortable with it.
You sound like the other kind of person that enjoys change and challenge.
Yes.
Now, you've decided from a career perspective for the best part of 15, 20 years to be that consultant or interim staff role. Is that different from being the routine employee?
Oh, absolutely. You are viewed differently by management and by the company employees, which is a good thing because you do not have to deal with so many of the culture issues that may hamper the internal employees. You're able to define them, set them aside, and work on the problems that need to be corrected, the accounting problems.
So you're very focused. You
yes,
get the job done.
Absolutely.
And you're going to be paid a higher rate for the fact that you're coming in doing something interim. Is there a higher level of expectation placed on you by management?
Oh, absolutely. And with the consulting industry comes a need for maintaining your knowledge in a very current, up-to-date fashion. The last consulting firm I was with had an excellent educational program, and we were required to take courses every month and to make a certain grade so that when we went out to the client, we were able to hit the ground running. We were expected to be productive on day one, and more often than not, we were. And we were also expected to provide the client with status reports. And these status reports were really helpful. They kept all of us informed so that we could all agree on what we were meant to do, what we were doing, and did we need to make a shift, and where we really wanted to be.
And I think that is the difference between what I would describe as a staffing company versus one that is giving advisory type services. And I think your role has spanned both. You've given advice from a technical and accounting and a day-to-day perspective, but you've also been the advisor to recommend what I would describe as significant change. You've helped companies change the course of direction of dropping vendors, creating new accounting operations. Business has changed as a result of you being into the companies that you've been in.
Absolutely. When I go into the companies, it's always with the thought that there is a restructure process going on. It could be a large restructuring of the company that involves other departments that need to be integrated with accounting. It can be just a small segment of accounting, but it all is a restructuring, is a change.
Can you ever imagine you going into a company and just doing the day-to-day, closing the books for a stable company, or would you be bored?
Be bored.
I hear you loud and clear. Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the risks involved of being a controller and the roles that you've had. As a controller, what have you seen within business that keeps you up at night?
I think the major risk is that of the unknown, the unexpected, and the unpredictable. We learn the business as quickly as we can, and we try to understand all the aspects of it, but there's always something out there somewhere that you haven't captured that you're going to worry about. The contract that no one recorded that is still out there that hasn't been performed upon. And when you are completing your financials, you think you've captured everything significant. But then the contract comes about, and you realize you have to perform on that contract, and you're not set up to do it. You didn't expect it. And it's going to take time, resources, personnel, et cetera. That's just one example, but there are many examples that do occur.
So the risk of the unknown. Mm-hmm. A little bit about closing your eyes at night and not really knowing what you're going to be dreaming about.
Right, and also some of these complex situations are not difficult to solve. And so your brain keeps working on them. How am I going to get from A to Z? you know, I've worked successfully, you know, A, B, C, D, E, but, you know, I'm kind of stuck here for a little bit. Now where do I go? How do I get the documentation?
And is that where you go back to the beginning
it
of our conversation to the T accounts?
It's exactly that, and the beginning of the audit trail, and where it veers off. And you're often reliant on other people's information. This is the hard part, because you then have to quickly look at their information to see if it makes sense, if it's supportable, if it's supportable to the point where you want to integrate it into your own documentation.
Well, we unfortunately are coming towards the end of the show, and I know that from a personal perspective, I could keep having the dialogue with you about controls and the process change and the effectiveness and efficiency change that you've brought in, as well as the restatements. But I'm going to ask you one final question. We have a tradition on the show to ask our guests, what is their CFO tip of the month? From the perspective of the controller, what is yours?
I think my tip of the month would be that remember and understand that mistakes happen. Everyone makes them. I have seen the most experienced, intelligent, successful folks make big, big mistakes and little mistakes. The idea is to try to figure out why it occurred, fix the process, and move on.
Fixing the process. I like that. That's a great tip. Thank you very much. And I would like formally to thank you, Gloria. It's been a pleasure having you on our radio show. Thank you for sharing your innermost thoughts on the role of the CFO from the controller's perspective.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Lorraine.
And we'd also like to thank our contributor, CFO.com. Thanks to our sponsors, Delaney Consulting, providing CFOs and controllers to Fortune 1000 companies and small businesses alike. For more information about Delaney, go to www.delaneyllc.com. Thanks also to National Association of Corporate Directors, Advancing Exemplary Board Leadership for Directors by Directors. See their website at nacdonline.org. This and other thought leadership from today's CFO is available right from your computer at cforadio.com. If you are a CFO or a controller and would like to be a guest on the show, please contact us via the web. Thanks for listening to CFO Radio. This is Lorraine Chilvers signing off. Until next time.